Thank you all for tuning in to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you'd like to find out more about this project, you can do so at the podcast website, lastborninthewilderness.com. That link to that site will be in the description of this episode. Everything you would ever want to know about this project can be found there. You'll find contact information. You will find all the social media sites that this podcast is updated regularly on. You will find all of the various streaming sites that this podcast is now streaming from. That includes iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. Also, you will find links to the one-time donation page, which is the Ko-fi page, as well as the Patreon page. You can go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness, and by going to that Patreon page, you can make very small monthly contributions to the production of this podcast. You can do as little as $1 a month, and by doing that, you will gain access to these conversations, to these interviews, a week in advance. Ultimately, this podcast will always be free, and it'll always be ad-free and sponsor-free, so if you would please consider, and you enjoy the work that I'm doing, please consider helping support me in this project. Thank you all for your attention. Now on with the episode. I speak with Max Dashew. Max is the founder of the Suppressed Histories Archive, an expansive archive of a lifetime of work uncovering and documenting the history of women in ancient cultures around the world. Max has just released a book very recently titled Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion, the years 700 to 1100. Max does these really remarkable presentations. She brings all of these slides, and she has this really deep well of knowledge that she has accumulated over decades of delving into this subject. And she presents it in such an engaging and in such a fascinating manner. And what she really does is she shows not only what ancient cultures looked like, how they operated, but also ultimately what role women had in these ancient cultures and how women played a very central and very powerful role in the shaping of early human cultures. In the art and the various other artifacts that are discovered and presented in her presentations and in her book ultimately demonstrate someone who's very on the ball, as it were, with actually understanding and contextualizing the present moment, because we can't understand how we've gotten to where we are without understanding the past and understanding that there are certain threads of history, large segments of our past that have been ultimately suppressed through either soft or through hard censorship. The soft censorship being just the fact that it was ignored for so long, and that many of the people that were delving into early history had a very patriarchal bias, I would say, and were unable to perceive what ancient cultures really were actually comprised of and how they actually worked, and how women play such a central and important role in the development of these cultures. So we get into some really interesting topics in this conversation. We talk about her book. We talk about the traditions that have ultimately, I guess what I ask her is, the question is, you know, what kind of worldview do these people have? You know, what was lost in the so-called progress of becoming modern people? I really enjoy this conversation because I have been on this role, I've been thinking a great deal about these very seemingly invisible events that we don't acknowledge or understand that may have taken place over hundreds or thousands of years, but ultimately long unfolding trends that have ultimately led us to where we are today. So my interest in, say, witches and pagans in this particular episode, or in women's role in early ancient human cultures, has to do with my broader interest of understanding we are in a time of great crisis on this planet, and it's coming at us from multiple angles. How can we understand how we got to this point? Because I think that is a big part of deciding what we can do to potentially alleviate and adapt to the very rapidly shifting landscape that we are all in on this planet. So I hope that my conversations with someone like Max really puts this all in context for other people, realizing that there are certain forms of knowledge and wisdom that have ultimately almost completely disappeared from this planet. But thanks to people like Max, as well as many others, you know, this information is being preserved, and we can begin to look at it again and try to understand what was lost in this transition that we have undergone these past several centuries. So, without any further ado, actually, let me say this real quick. Suppressedhistories.net, that is the website. You'll find everything that she has done. You'll find the book, link to the book, Witches and Pagans. You'll find her DVDs, discs that you can buy that have her presentations on them. You'll also find all the other writings and all the other things that she has done with this project that she has undergone. Without any further delay on my part, here is my conversation with Max Dashew. Thank you. So I came across your work, which you have called the Suppressed Histories.
Suppressed Histories Archives.
Mm-hmm. Suppressed Histories Archives, excuse me. There's the full title there. And you recently, from what I understand, you've released a book, which is the first in a series of books that you're planning on releasing. Is that right?
Yes. It's actually volume 7 of that series. I kind of started in the middle
because
that was the book I started to write, and it kind of grew, and what were chapters became volumes.
Well, that tends to happen, especially when you delve into the subjects that you delve into in your work. I imagine there's just I imagine that once you start doing what you're doing, there's just so much information to document and to write about that to try to summarize it into a few chapters is not going to do it any justice. If you could, I would really appreciate it if you could share with us what your work is about, what your book is, and what you're trying to accomplish.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's several great questions. Yeah.
It is.
Okay.
Yes.
First of all, the larger work is global women's history and digging that out, because we have not gotten that, you know, in our educational system. It is not delivered to us either through the media or most of the stories that are told about humanity. So that's my starting point, looking really internationally for different stories about women than the ones that we are always told. You know, you have the classic, you know, as people say women's history, and they think, okay, Susan B. Anthony, Queen Elizabeth I, and very narrow idea of that. And so I want to look at indigenous history, at archaeological finds, just really casting a broad net across the cultural record and seeing what turns up about women around that and how different some of the things that you can find are from what we've been told of who women are. So that's the Suppressed Histories Archives. The book is a subset of all of that, but it's really looking at what happened in Europe. How did we go from the egalitarian Neolithic societies, the megalith builders, to the classical civilizations of Greece and Rome and the patriarchies that exist there? And, you know, what were the ways that women were colonized in those societies, as well as later on, I look at the Germanic cultures and others, the Celtic, but, and how even in those societies, we have female priesthoods, we still have female spheres of power. And how did women become banned from the priesthood, from spiritual leadership and authority? And then over a period of long time, over the course of several millennia, we have this process of witch hunting that happened. So that's the political dimension of the series of books, which is called Secret History of the Witches. But the spiritual dimension is something very core to what I'm looking for, which is what are the authentic spiritual heritages in Europe before Christianity, before feudalism, even before the Roman Empire? And, you know, what can we track? What remains? What fragments can we try to piece together about all these ethnic traditions? And, you know, whether it's Baltic or Celtic or Italian or Germanic, you know, the whole spectrum of it.
Right.
Because a lot of people, you know, more and more looking around and saying, you know, is this all there is? And so it's something we need to know about. And it's fascinating, actually, once you start looking into this. It's actually kind of surprising to me how much does remain. So the current volume is called Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion. And the time span I'm looking at there is roughly 700 to 1100. So it's the early Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And that's a time when you have official Christianization, but you also have the persistence of these older ethnic spiritual ways. And so I'm really looking in depth in that book at what those ways were, who are the goddesses, the fates, the ancestral traditions, you know, the elves and the fairies and things like that, which I'll elaborate more in later volumes. And, you know, who were the seers in those societies? Who were the healers? You know, what were they called? You know, this word witch has been so demonized. And mm-hmm. and in this particular book, I have a whole chapter about names of the witch, unpacking all of that. What did witch originally mean? What were the names for witch in all of these different languages of Europe? Mm-hmm. And what I discovered is that the great majority of the names, especially the old names, mean things like seer, knower, prophet, healer, shapeshifter, and things like that, that are really very clearly descriptive of the spiritual dimension, you know, the spiritual offices. And that's very different from what we've been trained to think about with the witch.
Mm, yeah. You know, in the, I was watching a presentation that you were giving, it was on a YouTube video, but you were showing all of these, as you mentioned in the beginning of what you were saying, you know, all around the world, there are all of these, very old ancient, cultures that revered women, that had, a very important role for women, or women had made themselves a very important role in their societies and in their cultures. And, something that seems to run through a lot of these ancient artistic depictions is something that I really want to ask you about, because I don't know much about it, and I think it's really fascinating. But there's this, first of all, there's a lot of ecstatic dancing. There's some sort of depiction of reverie, of some kind of reaching some sort of spiritual plane through rhythmic dancing or what have you. And then oftentimes what's depicted is shapeshifting. There's oftentimes a woman shaman who seems to be in combination with some animal. And this seems to be depicted all over the world. This is a common pattern. So I guess part of that, what I really want to ask is that, what I find so fascinating about that is that I think that by looking through that artwork, we kind of get a glimpse into the worldview of these people, how they viewed reality, how they viewed themselves, how they viewed the natural world. And of course, I'm sure they wouldn't even use any of those terms to describe it, mm-hmm. but they have this way of looking at things that seems so alien from where I stand. And so I really want to cross that barrier so that I don't feel so much like an alien to those concepts. So if I could ask you, in your opinion, or from what can be understood from these artistic depictions, you know, what was the worldview of these much older, more ancient cultures?
Well, this is something, especially for the ancient cultures, it's to some degree conjectural, because there's sure. so much we're missing. We're not getting the oral tradition at all. We're looking at ancient artifacts or rock paintings, you know, sculptures, things like that. But they do the images carry a lot of information, you know, and there is an interpretive factor involved, but you see again and again, for example, I have a DVD I did called Woman Shaman, the Ancients, where I was trying to basically document the cultural record that that I was able to find for these spiritual ecstatics. And the first chapter is of invocation, because there is this universal global pattern of very predominantly women. I'm not saying men never did this, or that there are no men, but the pattern that I see in the archaeology is overwhelmingly female, of women standing with their arms raised in invocation, with the palms facing out toward, you know, the onlooker. Mm-hmm. And this is everywhere. It's everywhere. And so that calling in is sort of the beginning phase of a whole unfoldment that happens, and sacred dance, drumming, incantation. There are many ways to enter into these states of deep spiritual union. And this is where you get people talking about experiencing, you know, they have encounters with beings who may take animal forms, or they themselves may shift into animal form, or they may ride on the back of an animal spirit. And this whole area of spirit journeys, you know, these are commonalities that you can find, whether it's in representations from ancient Eurasia or, you know, different parts of the world. We see this representation of women riding on the backs of animals. You see it in Taoist China, many, many places, or whether it is more recent living cultural testimony that is something that was told to someone who wrote it down. And so it's possible to track that. You know, there are, I think really what we're seeing is that human beings, the scientists tell us we're only using 10% of our brain. We have faculties that have been really crushed to some degree by this civilization that we live in, the way that everyone is socialized, the fact that you're supposed to sit in chairs in rows in school for 8 hours a day in childhood, this linear mentality that is the dominant way of molding people's consciousness blocks us from developing awareness and the faculties we do have as humans to be able to have psychic perception, understanding of, you know, like just the flow of energy and being able to do healing acts, so that we are actually at a disadvantage in that way because we've been hobbled mentally and spiritually from developing those faculties to the point where many people will deny that they even exist. And I think at this stage, most people will recognize that. I mean, you have people who come down with very serious illnesses, and after the doctors have failed them, they go around looking for medicine people or other healers. And so, you know, our modern healers, there are all kinds of amazing modalities that are unfolding with energy work, working on the body, you know. But I think that there's this way that we have to feel our way back into the fullness of what it means to be human, and not just the left brain, but also the dreaming right brain.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think what I've come to realize is that, while the scientific worldview is important, of course, for what it can provide in understanding. I think that in order for the scientific worldview to become the dominant worldview, it had to be through suppression and through very coercive and violent methods. It seems that in order for the scientific worldview, in order for that to become the dominant worldview, we get to certain events in history like the witch hunts in Europe.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and also just in relation to science, what is really fascinating is in the last 100 years, how science has begun to approximate and reapproach some of these teachings, you know, Taoist or Hindu teachings. You know, it's like all of the collapse of objectivism, you know, of an absolute materialist viewpoint, which dissolves once you begin to realize, well, actually, we can't really pinpoint the electrons. We could only do probability curves. We, you know, there are these indeterminate factors, and then there is the influence of the observer in the results of scientific experiments, so that perception once again comes into view. You know, there's a lot of really exciting things happening. Epigenetics, so many different developments in physics and in biology, which are again highlighting the importance of the energetic.
Right.
And even intention.
Yeah. It seems like we're coming full circle back to the wisdom that has existed for so long in indigenous cultures around the world. And it's... It seems like we've had to go on a pretty long journey,
it seems, to get there.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember there was, I think it was an article that was published in National Geographic, and I just remember the headline, but it was something like, and I'm going to butcher the headline here, but it's something like, when science learns what indigenous cultures have known all along, or something like that, it's like... The indigenous cultures may not have developed the scientific method, but they certainly understood how to deal with, how to heal the body and how to do certain kinds of healing, engage in certain healing practices in order to provide the needs that were necessary. I'm sorry, that was kind of an odd sentence, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that this has always been here. It's just a matter of acknowledging it. And I think the work that you're doing is so important in that regard, because I don't even know how many years of your life that you have spent doing this, but I know that it's been a pretty significant chunk of it, I imagine.
48.
Okay. Yeah, that is a very significant chunk. Okay. And you have been compiling all this information in order to provide a very cohesive and very coherent understanding of what has been suppressed. And by revitalizing that and bringing it back up, I think that we can then reflect on the very strange journey that we have gone down as a species, and hopefully be able to revive many of those old practices in some form or another.
It's already happening. It's starting to happen. And, you know, what I would say about my work is I see it as provisional, because I'm really looking at ripped shreds of culture. And so it's piecing things back together, and I'm always correcting, you know, it's like, because I'm dependent on certain kinds of sources, and I'm always looking more for the indigenous testimony, but that is not always available to me. And so I'm always trying to find that and fold that in, you know, and to recenter women, especially because, you know, there is this masculine default in the way that culture is portrayed. The way that knowledge is portrayed. I mean, even the word science, there's been this movement in the last 30 years called Indigenous Mind or Indigenous Knowledge Systems or to various different titles, basically acknowledging that there are sciences, there are ways of knowing. They are not linear. They are not authoritarian in the way that we've become accustomed to. If you look at medicine, that's a exhibit A for the authoritarian aspects of science. But, you know, it's a process of attempting to reconstruct, which is, you know, there's really no end to that. I mean, I'm making an attempt, but I realize there are limitations to what I can find or what I can know. And there are some things that won't be recovered. You know, there are the little wooden statues, whether they're in Europe or in South America or various different places, that were burned by the missionaries, you know, of ancestral beings or deities, you know, and we're never going to get those back. But it's amazing what we can find.
Yeah, it is amazing what has been left for us to discover. So I want to ask you, like, what was the progression from these these sort of animistic pre-Christian cultures that had existed. That's maybe narrow our focus to Europe, because I know that's what your book most recently is about, Witches and Pagans, is about. Because I think oftentimes when we think of Europe, we of course think of a very male-centric mm-hmm. civilization, right? But as you have demonstrated, and as others have demonstrated, that there very much is a very strong case to be made that women had a very central and very important role in early European cultures. Mm-hmm. So if I could ask you, what did those cultures look like? What was the framework of those societies? Like, how do they operate? And right. then maybe from there, how did we get what we have today?
Is the question. And that's what I set out to find out in The Secret History of the Witches, you know, is to answer that question. What you're asking, you know, this is not a simple thing that I can say, well, you know, everything was great before Christianity. What I'm showing in Witches and Pagans is that it is already a patriarchal culture. Even the pre-Christian cultures, with exception maybe of the Basques, are already to some degree patriarchal. Even the Celtic, which you will often see described as this wonderland of egalitarianism. You know, they're Indo-European societies, and we know that long, long ago, Indo-European societies, as the language shows us, was already patrilineal, already class-ranked, chieftaincies and things like that. So that's a reality in it. But what I've seen, and this is not true only for Europe, but globally, is that even in a society which is patriarchal in many ways, you can have female spheres of power. And that's how I would describe Europe in the period after the fall of the Roman Empire, in the Celtic, the Slavic, the Norse, all these different societies, is you have still existing female spheres of power in prophecy, in healing, as priestesses, you know, leading of ceremony, things like that, that did give women self-determination and some area of control, even if they were marrying in to the man's family and going to live with him. And there are certain structural aspects that were male dominant, frankly. So this is a complex picture. It's not a simple narrative of, you know, everything was great before Christianity, but there's no doubt that Christianization, which was also a form of Romanization of these societies, using Latin, using the Greek scriptures, right, the Christian Bible, and all of the anti-idolatry provisions in there that mobilized them, basically an authoritarian religious outlook that called for the destruction of everything that existed in the society before, that everything had to be put under this new template. Nothing else could exist. Priests had to be male. The mass had to be said in Latin. There could be no other forms of deity, although the common people really got around that through disguising their divinities as saints. But that's some background. But to answer your question more directly now, we have Europe, first of all, you have to understand, and this is relevant to the name of your program, Last Born in the Wilderness. Mm-hmm. Most of Europe was forested. It was wildness, and people were very close to the land. They were living in villages. You know, there were animals all around. Nature was all around, and this was really an animistic, spiritual way in each of these ethnic traditions that people followed. They didn't just rip plants out of the ground. They invoked them. They prayed to them. They told them, this is what I need you for. They might sprinkle some meal or some spices into the ground as, you know, a return. Mm-hmm. And this animistic, the idea that spirit inhabits everything, and that stones have power, and that consciousness can be changed by immersion in the waters. You know, the Scots, for example, and this is not so long ago, actually,
We have Scottish healers in the 16 and 1700s still using water taken from the crest of nine waves as for healing, using stones, placing stones on the body for healing, procession around certain lakes as part of a healing modality. You know, healer would say, okay, you know, I want you to go walk around this lake as part of a real holistic process. It's not that they didn't give herbs, because they did, and not only to be taken internally or in herbal baths, but also to be tied on the body. We see a lot of description of this in the 7th century, 8th century priestly sources scolding people because they were going to see healers and diviners that were called arioli. And they were blessing herbs, and they were tying herbs or other objects onto the body of the person to be healed. So this is getting a lot closer to what are called medicine bundles in North America, in Native mm-hmm. culture. The idea that energy can be invoked into things, or that there is a divine essence in the plant itself, the stone, whatever it is that they're working with, and that can be used to shift patterns of disease, for example, can be used to protect. In the Germanic world, runes were not ever strictly an alphabet, but were actually a cosmological system with a meaning attached to each symbol, and these were cast as lots. And so they could get guidance through divination. This is long before tarot cards. There were so many different things there. And in Witches and Pagans, I look a lot at the words tell us a lot. We may not be able to always get full descriptions of what the witch healers were doing, but there are all these very interesting clusters of words. And if you look at the etymology, for example, in Anglo-Saxon, there's this beautiful name for witch, Lubestr, which basically means medicine woman. Lib is related to our word life, and it is also, this root gives us words for herb in Norse, for amulet in Anglo-Saxon, for various words having to do with healing and medicine in different Germanic languages. And so there's this whole complex around that, and it's very clearly based in the idea of life force, you know, working with life force and the medicine people. And the collective nature of village communities is part of it. You know, these are pre-capitalist societies. Mm-hmm. And so very parallel, I think, to what you see in indigenous societies today. You're not necessarily born into a class where it's like, okay, you're going to be a priest. But instead, it's much more a case of spirit selection. There are dreaming experiences that the person will have where spirits will appear to them in the form of wolf or whatever animal, mm-hmm. raven, and they begin to perhaps have an initiatory illness. But in any case, they emerge with certain kinds of knowledge and certain gifts, which people around them then perceive, wow, yeah, go to her. She can tell you. She knows. She knows things. She can see things. You know,
right.
And that's so it's really by you become a spiritual seer, not by declaring yourself as such, but by community recognition that, yeah, this is the person who can help you with that.
Yeah. You know what I think, you know, when you just said that, it just triggered something inside me. You know, for so long, I've been very wary of individuals who claim that they can do some sort of spirit healing or spirit energy, or that they're seers, or that they're mediums, or, you know, whatever they want to call themselves. Mm-hmm. Because I think what often I sense is that they're trying to manipulate gullible people. And I think that that is often the case. But when you just said that, when you said that this individual, this woman, was recognized by the community as being somebody who could do this. That is a completely different thing. Mm-hmm. That is a community effort. That is some that, and that actually plays into a bit of how I found you, I think, because I was getting in really interested in the transformation that that European society went through as a result of the development of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And I became aware of this author named Silvia Federici, who had written this book, Caliban and the Witch, which is a fantastic book. And I had read that book and I interviewed her a few months ago and it was fantastic. But I wanted to get more in depth into some of the more like the nitty gritty of like what exactly these cultures look like and what they felt like and what they represent. And that's of course how I was led to your work. But so much of what I feel has been lost and what needs to be reclaimed is this sense of community. And then, and a part of that is to create, to recreate, I guess, communities that, that have a very sacred and right role for individuals that, I remember I had read some theory, I don't know how true this is, but that, that there's a very small percentage of the human population that are schizophrenic. And that in indigenous cultures, they have very low rates of what would be mental illness, they would call mental illness. And part of that is part just because of the fact that they're more egalitarian. They don't ostracize individuals that are different in that regard. But they also, they find people that may be very, what we would label as mentally ill or having some sort of handicap. And they see them as somebody who's able to actually do something very, something that is absolutely necessary in their community, in their village, in their tribe. And so when you said that, it just triggered this, this thing inside me where I think that to me is one of the most tragic things about the modern world is that there are so many groups of people, so many individuals, and women are a big part of this, that have been cast aside as irrelevant and and not useful to the program that we're supposed to follow. And so when I read your work and I listen to you speak about this, I get this feeling like you're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct in wanting to bring to light all of these subjects and all of these suppressed histories, because I think a lot of people sense that something is wrong. And I think that a lot of the maybe the social unrest that we're experiencing today and why there has been this resurgence of interest in these subjects is because we sense that something just doesn't feel right about our modern time.
People are in pain. I mean, this opioid crisis, people are in a lot of psychic pain and, you know, crack before that. And it's just like, you know, there are many structures of oppression in this society and people don't know anymore how to get out of their pain. You know, so that's something where there's a really a need for ceremonial culture and for reconstruction of community. And what you said before, I mean, there's a couple things you touched on. One, this concept of, you know, actually anthropologists regarded shamans as mentally ill. And they noted that some of them were epileptic and that for them was a sign of mental illness on some level, you know. There are so many lenses that this was put through, especially in the initial lens that was turned on these shamanic cultures from the Western civ viewpoint. And I think you're right, even beyond people who have schizophrenic or whatever other, you know, differences in perception, you know, there are certainly faculties there. It doesn't mean that because you have this, that you will become a shaman. But I think there are great many people, and not only quote unquote mentally ill people, but people who are neurologically different abled. I mean, you've got people we now label as Asperger's or autistic or things that don't even maybe have names to them, who, you know, dyslexic. Their faculties work in a different way, and it's very difficult for them in a society that's all organized according to linear principles. Dyslexic people can't do it, but they probably, I think, have other capacities which are simply denied development in the way this culture is structured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's so many angles to this.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, it's so rich. There's so many things that can be gathered from this information. So I think what's interesting is I feel like this information that you're bringing up really does tie into the broader feminist movement. And I know that feminism is a very broad term, especially now. There's a lot of different isms, I guess you could say, within feminism. But I think ultimately what your work is doing is a form of empowerment for women, because it's reestablishing the fact that women have always had a very necessary and important role within society, and that patriarchy is a real thing. I think now we're actually seeing a really interesting trend where it was kind of an accepted thing for a bit. I felt like that patriarchy was sort of an accepted, that we are a part of a patriarchal society. But now there's this whole movement that's sort of claiming that, no, that's not even real. That's a fabrication or something. But I do feel that what your work is doing is it's giving it a huge scope of history. You're really showing that these cultures have existed. They were suppressed and ultimately destroyed by what we would call patriarchal cultures. Well, maybe not exactly in those terms, but you know, the church and the various political institutions that came along with that.
The church and state.
The church and state.
Empire. Yeah. You know, all of these ways of appropriating and seizing power. Yeah. You know, I really wanted to, I set out to, number one, find out, are there cultures where women are free on this planet? That was my starting point. But along the way, you know, I saw how it was necessary to also document patriarchy and how that works, colonialism and how that works. I mean, all these axes of domination intertwine with each other. You know, and so you need to have a different kind of history that really looks at those things, you know, not a history of kings and generals, although that is going to come into it because of the damage they wrought, but also a history that shows, you know, that the existence of these female spheres of power, the priestesses, the women shamans, the elders, the clan mothers, you know, the societies who are structured, putting women at the center, you know, the matriarchal cultures. So because not at the center because females are better than males, but simply because women are the life bearers. And so in a patriarchal society, the whole thing is set up to try and control that reproductive power, you know, to appropriate it to male control. But in a matriarchal culture, men and women together as sisters and brothers are the clan and the children. It's a bloodline. In patriarchy, it's a legal line. It is male authority by fiat, by law. And so one really important study for history is to look at how these authoritarian structures got embedded in law. Not only male control of females, but also slavery, also class systems. All of these interact with each other in ways that, you know, are really worth looking at. And so when we see those patterns, what we understand is that patriarchy is not, as we have been told, a universal or, you know, for all historical time. It is a historical development. It's a process. And you can watch it unfold. You know, you can document it sometimes where there's a written record, but there's a lot of evidence for this trend toward a patriarchal control of women. And so, you know, that is a very different kind of history. I mean, I've presented to like high school students and people who, you know, they're kind of sitting there slumped in their chairs, and I bring in visual talks, which is what I do. And, you know, I think that teaching with images is really powerful because it's not just me saying what I think, but you can see it. And more importantly, you can feel it. You can feel the difference in what it's like to have a priestess doing sacramental dance in Togo, for example, you know, and to see the dynamism of that, and to see the open public power of it, you know, and to see spirit flowing through her, and to realize this is something very different, because in Western civ, and especially now, women are so demoralized. You know, we are taught that our bodies are not okay the way they are. We have to do all these things to our bodies. We're not acceptable. We have to hold ourselves in certain ways, speak in certain ways. We have to giggle nervously in response, you know, in these male-female dynamics that have been embedded very deeply, you know, in the process of the witch hunts. All of that is taken as a given in U.S. society, but yet, if you go on a global level and you see all of these other ways of being, and you see that actually, you know, we haven't always been caught in this trick bag. You know, we have always, patriarchy is a protection racket, but, you know, so there's this idea that you have to obey certain kinds of rules in order to be safe. And yet, as Audre Lorde said, You aren't going to be safe. Keeping silent is not going to keep you safe. You know, you have to change the system that is doing this to you. You know, you have to break out. And I think the power of socialization is very great, which is why I think history becomes so important, and especially being able to viscerally experience history through images, because it shows you it doesn't have to be this way. It hasn't always been this way. In fact, we even have photographic evidence of societies where it still is not an absolute of domination.
Right. You know, I'm just going to kind of try to articulate this question to the best of my ability to you. Something that I've maybe it's an intuition or something like that, but I feel like part of the witch hunts and the suppression of women and these practices that have been passed down from generation to generation through women was in many ways a fear or a rejection of some kind of the natural world. And what I mean by that, of course, is that women and witches and what has been written in the demonization of women and of witches during the witch hunts was that oftentimes they were associated with the devil, but also with goats and different animals and this sort of like orgiastic covens. And there's all of this very primal, very much about the body and very much about being connected to the land and the natural world. And I know that this maybe is just, I don't know if this fits into your work exactly, but I just want to ask you your opinion on this. What was it? Why is it that men, and maybe it's particularly the Christianized view of this, but why is it that men became so afraid of women and and also their connection to what seems to be the natural world? I mean, that to me is what's so perplexing, is that by women having these very important roles in societies, it seems that those societies tended to be more peaceful. They were more egalitarian. Mm-hmm. They were less prone to going to war and having these fights over property and things like that.
But women had a say.
Yeah.
If women have a say, then war is really curbed. You see that with the native, you know, with the Iroquoian nations and the Cherokee. There was a female veto to war. And that's true in some of the other major cultures in Southeast Asia and different places.
So women generally were always like, wait, let's think about this for a second.
You know, they're also thinking about what's the effect going to be on their family. Because, you know, after a while you start to see the destructiveness of war and, you know, you lose your children. You are driven out. You know, it's a destructive thing. I mean, sometimes you need to fight because you're being invaded. But in answer to the earlier question, I'm just trying to remember where you were going with that.
I know I was a bit of a stretch, and I apologize, but no, it was more about women's something
the body,
about how
the body,
the body.
The spirit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I mean, there are even quotes from priests in the late Middle Ages. Eve was carnal, but Adam was a spirit from God, things like that. I mean, this Carolyn Merchant in The Death of Nature, I think that's the name of her book, really documents how thinkers like Bacon and Descartes, the whole base of modern Western science, you know, really had this very strong equation of women with nature. And Susan Griffin also in her book, Women and Nature, talks about this, you know, and that the idea of the male as more spiritual, as closer to God, as being really the image of God. This is the Christian interpretation. And so then women, because nature was seen as lesser, rather than the idea of spirit moving through nature, now nature is something bad. Sexuality is bad. Sexuality has to be controlled in certain ways. All of the seven deadly sins, you know, this is a demonization of nature in many ways. And the whole burden of it all is thrown on women. The burden of male sexuality is thrown on women, which you also see in Islam, the concept of fitna, disorder, as originating from uncontrolled female sexuality, including uncovered hair. These are patriarchal constructs where, you know, really, I think the root of it is what we could reverse out Freud and call Venus envy. You know, the idea that men saw aspects of female power and tried to appropriate that sexual and reproductive power, as well as women's labor power. And so there was this imperative to colonize. And in order to do that colonization, they evolved an ideology of male supremacy, you know, that made women into carnal and inherently more demonic, resting very heavily on the concept of Eve, right? The original chapter. And, you know, Eve sinned and caused Adam to fall. And original sin, the concept that's not actually in the Bible, but Augustine devised, really heavily colors the way that European Christianity evolved. So that you have this essentially fallen nature of matter away from quote unquote God. And so this is diametrically opposed to the pagan worldviews, just looking within Europe, which are seeing the divine moving through streams and present in forests and great old growth trees and giving signs, not something dead, but something that is nature is resonant and magnetic and can be communicated with. You know, that when the raven calls at a certain moment, pay attention, you know, that this is an omen. It means something. Yeah. And so that interrelationship with the natural world is really key to the old heathen cultures in Europe. And this is exactly what gets stamped out as being devil worship under the Christian regimes. I mean, you do have Christian saints also who have interactions with animals because this was too embedded in the culture. Even the Christians were, especially in the period I'm talking about in witches and pagans, were basically soaking in a culture that was full of heathen holidays and place names and concepts, the words that they used for healing. All of these, the whole web of culture was very much still the old ethnic culture, whatever language it was that they were speaking. And so even they could not help but articulate things sometimes in heathen terms.
Actually just less than a month ago, it's been about a month ago, I had the good fortune to go to Europe for the very first time. I went to Ireland and Scotland, and my fiance now, we had the opportunity to go to Roslyn Chapel, which is in the Highlands of Scotland, and it was built in mid to late 1400s, I believe. And what's so interesting about it is that it's such a beautifully built chapel. But within the chapel, there's at least 100 or so of these green men faces that are carved among all of the other biblical stories that are displayed there. And when you have a tour, when they talk about it, they're like, yeah, so this is kind of the time when Europe was transitioning from its original pagan roots into a more Christian worldview. And so you have this sort of in-betweenness that you see, particularly in early Christian art. It's quite a fascinating thing to realize that this was a transition, and it was a violent transition, unfortunately. To get from there to here where we are now. What I absolutely love about your work is it puts everything in a broader context. It makes you think about, well, where do I stand in this big thing that we call human history? And I think it's just an absolutely stunning thing that you have managed to do. So I'm very grateful for you taking the time to answer some of my questions and have this conversation with me. And I would really appreciate if you could direct people to your website, your work, and also talk about upcoming events, upcoming work that you are planning on releasing. That would be fantastic.
Sure. Well, first off, people should visit the Suppressed Histories Archives website, which is suppressedhistories.net. Mm-hmm. And also, if you want to get the book, Witches and Pagans, it's available from Valletta Press. That's my press. And that's VELEDA.net. And there's also a newer book, the Deosophy Coloring Book, which is a goddess and spirits, female spirits coloring book that's much more international. The next book that's coming out later this year will be on the Hellenic cultures. And it's called Pythias, Melissae, and Pharmakides, some of the titles for female spiritual leaders in that tradition. Mm-hmm. I do webcasts. And so if you look at the events page, I'm doing one tonight, actually, on goddess wisdom. You can look at the events page and you can subscribe. You can register for those webcasts. And so it's all through the internet, which I really love being able to do that. And I'm going to be doing more and more of that, sharing not only the European material, but the more international shows as well. And I'm teaching an online course, which you can also access through the Suppressed Histories website, that is basically, right now it's called Treasures of Women's History, and it's an international scope that is pulling in research on female shamans, matriarch cultures, goddesses, women's history in general. And so that's a pretty low fee per month, and you get the webcasts for free in that.
Okay. Wonderful. Yeah, I will definitely make it very easy for people to find all of those links. I'm going to put that in the description of this episode and make it so people can have, yeah, of course. I always try to make it as easy as possible for people that are willing to listen to my podcasts, to find people like you, find your work, and have access to that. So, Max, I greatly appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you for listening to Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a wonderful week, and as a psychedelic bard, Terrence McKenna said, take it easy, dude, but take it.